Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Costanza Casati. Did I pronounce that correctly?
That was perfect.
I'm impressed. Costanza was born in Texas in 1995, but grew up in a village in northern Italy and lived in the UK for 5 years. Before moving to London, she attended a classical liceo in Italy where she studied ancient Greek and ancient Greek literature for 5 years. Costanza is a graduate of the prestigious Warwick Writing MA program where she earned a distinction and currently works as a freelance journalist and screenwriter. And the book that we're talking about today is Babylonia. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Costanza.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, and are you in London now?
I'm in Paris, actually, at the moment.
Yeah.
I've been staying in Paris for the past couple of months and kind of going back and forth between London and Paris. So, yeah, I'm feeling quite lucky right now.
So which one's your favorite, London or Paris?
London, for sure, just because I have lived in London for many years and it just holds a special place in my heart. But Paris is beautiful, so I cannot complain.
Of course. So Babylonia is set in what time period?
So Babylonia starts in 823 BC, and it is set in ancient Mesopotamia. So just for context, this is the ancient Near East, and it is an area that includes modern-day Iraq, part of modern-day Iran, part of Turkey, part of Syria. And it is, as a setting, incredibly fascinating, I would say, because this is the era where writing was first invented, where one of the first legal codes was created, where the first epic ever was written. And it was, it still is, but it was even then a very fertile land between two rivers, the River Tigris and Euphrates, and a place where many ancient empires expanded, including the Empire of Ancient Assyria, which is where my novel takes place.
So why is it called Babylonia?
So the title originally wasn't Babylonia. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because people never ask the question and then just come to the wrong conclusion. So the novel is set in Ancient Assyria, but the main character of Babylonia is Semiramis, who was both a legendary figure, as we'll probably talk about later, but also a real historical figure. And throughout the centuries, specifically within the Christian tradition, Semiramis has become almost the embodiment of this kind of lustful seductress. And she has been associated with Babylon, both as the city of Babylon, the ancient city of Babylon, and as this kind of place of lust and excess and dissolute power. And because in my novel I try to peel away all the layers and all the archetypes that Semiramis has had to suffer throughout the centuries and show kind of the real woman within, I thought it would be interesting to have Babylonia as a title, almost as a challenge to the way in which Semiramis has been perceived throughout the centuries.
Okay. What was the relationship between the Assyrian Empire at that time and Babylon?
Well, most of the time they were enemies. When we talk about ancient Assyria, we're usually talking about the Neo-Assyrian Empire, which, you know, started with King Ashurnasirpal and then kind of ended with the great Assurbanipal centuries later. And most of the time, Assyria and Babylonia were enemies. But then sometimes they were kind of allies. So when my novel starts in 823, my novel is both historical fiction and myth retelling, right? So some of the events are based on real historical facts, others are based on the myth. And in 823 BC, Assyria and Babylonia had just signed a treaty, essentially. And so for a few years, they were allies until Babylonia declared war against Assyria a few years later.
Now, when your novel set, where is that in sort of the overall scope of the Assyrian Empire, or what you call the Neo-Assyrian Empire? Is it near the beginning, near the end?
It is. So Ninus, one of the main characters of my novel, the king of Assyria at the time, he's based on the real historical king, Shamshiadad V. And Shamshiadad V was the third ruler of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. So he was the grandson of the first Neo-Assyrian ruler, Ashurnasirpal, whom I have mentioned before, and he was the son of Shalmaneser. So I would say toward the beginning.
So obviously you know an awfully lot about the history of this region. What drew you to this?
That's a great and tricky question, because it sounds really simple, but actually I always find it quite hard to explain what drew me to a story. I think for me, interest in a setting or in a character is never really enough to write a whole book about it. Usually what I need before writing a book is to not just feel, you know, a strong emotional connection with a scene from history or an event from history or the myth, but to have a very visceral emotional reaction to something from history or the myth. So in the case of Babylonia, what happened was that a few years ago, I discovered the character of Semiramis I. I was reading a book called On Famous Women by an Italian author called Giovanni Boccaccio, who lived in the 14th century BC. And he writes about Semiramis, about this incredible woman who was the only female ruler of the Assyrian Empire. He calls her skilled and spirited and intelligent. But obviously this was still, you know, a 14th century work, so a very moralizing work, as you can imagine. So by the end of his chapter on Semiramis, this author called Boccaccio says that there was one wicked sin that stained all Semiramis's accomplishments. And the sin was that she was burning with desire and she gave herself to many men. So I was, I know, it's hilarious, isn't it? And so I started researching her. I was interested in her right away, but I still didn't know if I actually wanted to write a book about her. So I started researching her, kind of looking for that emotional hook. And I found it in the tragic love triangle that eventually made Semiramis queen. So I was reading this other book called Universal History by an ancient Greek author called Diodorus of Sicily. And essentially Diodorus writes in detail about Semiramis. And he mentions this love triangle, which ended in tragedy and which also ended with Semiramis being queen. And there was this sentence in the writing of Diodorus that was so kind of cold and detached. It was written in a very businesslike way as he was, you know, writing about this tragedy. And that was my emotional hook. And that was the moment when I realized this is a story that I want to tell.
Can you share what that sentence is, or would it give away too much?
I think it would be a massive spoiler.
Okay. Okay.
That's also why I try not to. I love that sentence so much, but I try not to talk about it. But essentially, something that I can say without spoiling is that he is describing this tragic love triangle. And then by the end, after describing in detail the deaths of some of the characters, he says, "And this is how Semiramis attained the position of queen." And I was like, okay, there's a story here. And, you know, a story that I need to unpack. And, you know, I also love, there's an amazing quote by poet Robert Frost, where he talks about this in terms of inspiration for authors. And he says that if there are no tears, if there is no emotion in the writer, there will be no emotion in the reader. And I completely agree. You know, I know that if I don't have this strong emotional reaction to a story, my readers won't either. So.
Okay. So why did you start studying like ancient Greek and both the you studied the language and the literature?
I did. That was not really a choice. So as you said before, I was born in the US, but I grew up in Italy. And in Italy, some students attend what we call a liceo classico, which is basically a high school where classics are compulsory. So I studied ancient Greek and Latin for 5 years, from the age of 14 to the age of 19. So I was really, really young. I didn't necessarily want to study the classics, but I just hated studying classics, but I'm really glad I did now because you know, that allowed me to write my first novel and to, you know, become a history nerd. So, yeah.
Wow. So Your first novel was what was the title?
So my first novel is called Clytemnestra. It was published in 2023, and it is the story of one of the most infamous, if not the most infamous, woman from the Greek myth, Clytemnestra. Clytemnestra is quite well known in Greek mythology for two things, for being the sister of Helen of Troy, and also for murdering her husband, Agamemnon, as he came back from the Trojan War. So my first book kind of chronicles her life from her time as a Spartan woman up to her ascent to power in the city of Mycenae.
Okay, so it does seem like Greek myths and legends are getting, or the retelling is kind of having a moment in the publishing world today. Do you have any idea why, other than that there are fabulous authors like you who are doing this work, but why is it resonating so much with readers?
I think, well, on the one side, I think a lot of people know something about the Greek myths, and they're eager to know more. You know, it is kind of similar to reading a series of fantasy novels set in the same universe, right? So you read one novel and then you want to learn more and you want to see how all the pieces of the puzzle fit. And I think there's something about Greek mythology because it's such a rich mythology. You know, there are so many stories that readers love. But also, you know, when I think about this question, and I think about this a lot because it's true, you know, Greek myths are really having a moment. I think that on the one side, authors of retellings are doing nothing new, really. What we're doing now is something that the Greeks themselves were doing in the past. The most interesting thing about Greek myths is that each story has so many different versions. And this happened because in ancient history, these stories were transmitted by oral tradition. And so whenever the story was told and retold, it changed slightly according to whoever was telling it. So the process of retelling myths has always existed. But it is also true that we are doing something revolutionary by focusing most of the time on the women of the stories.
Right.
And I think this is the reason why people love reading the stories so much, because the focus on the women is, I use the word revolutionary because if we look at the ancient Greek word for myth, which was mythos, this is a word that excluded women. You know, it is a word that had many different meanings: myth, history, fiction, public speech. And the first time it is used in the Western literary tradition is in a speech where this man called Telemachus, Odysseus' son, tells his mother, "Mother, go back to your rooms because speech will belong to the men." And he uses the word mythos. So we are kind of changing almost now with these retellings, the original meaning of mythos as something that does not belong to women.
Wow. It's fascinating to me that with all of the misogyny and the, you know, discrimination against women in these time periods, how many women still succeeded in gaining power.
Absolutely.
And this is throughout history. This is not just ancient Greek and Assyria. It's, you know, it's like even in the 20th century, where like in India, which is a very patriarchal society, and yet they ended up with a female prime minister for, you know, as one of their most powerful and strongest leaders. And England in the, you know, the Elizabethan times and the Victorian time, you know, female leaders who are, they're the ones who expanded the British Empire. And so how do these women do it?
This is a great point, and it's something that I love to talk about, you know, female power. How did and how do women achieve power in a patriarchal world, and what are kind of the consequences of holding such power? And I think there are kind of two, I have two thoughts, well, many, but Let's narrow it down. I have two thoughts about this. The first is that with my novels specifically, because they tend to be set in ancient history, I like to show that female power is, as you were saying, not a recent phenomenon. You know, powerful women have always existed. It's just that they have either been forgotten or hated and vilified.
Right.
So when I write about a woman like Semiramis or a woman like Clytemnestra, it's not that I made them powerful. They were already powerful in the myth. They were already powerful in history. There is a great quote in the play, in the tragedy, Agamemnon by Aeschylus, which was one of my main sources for my debut novel, Clytemnestra. Which, you know, it's a play that, despite the title, actually has Clytemnestra as the main character. And in this line,
of course.
And in this line, the kind of counsel of the queen, of Queen Clytemnestra, tells her at some point, we respect your power, Clytemnestra. And they use the Greek word kratos, which means political power. So she was respected for the power she was holding. But the other thought that I have about female power is that women have always been seen as abusers of power rather than users of power. So they've always been seen as almost threats to be eliminated. And I think this is something that still happens in some shape or form. You know, when we have a particularly powerful female politician, we tend to destroy her. We tend to try and bring her down.
Yeah, well, that certainly happened in the U.S.
I know it did. And, you know, sadly, not the first time. Actually, yeah. You know, about the U.S. elections, I recently read this amazing book called Rodham by Curtis Sittenfeld, which kind of reimagines the life of Hillary Clinton, you know, if she hadn't married Bill. And it's a very interesting book because it is an exploration of the cost of female power. And I found so many similarities with, you know, powerful women in the ancient world, no matter your like or dislike towards someone like Hillary Clinton, you know.
Yeah. Well, I admire her greatly.
Yeah, so do I.
But it's interesting, too, though, that in more modern times, and maybe this is true with, how do you pronounce Semiramis?
Yeah, it's either Semiramis or Semiramis.
Okay, yes. Semiramis. That the women who have achieved power sometimes are very much, they don't help other women. You know,
yes. 100%, 100%, yes. And this is incredibly tricky, actually, to write about when you find yourself writing a book about a woman in power in ancient history. And I actually had to face this challenge while writing Babylonia. And I think I actually enjoyed exploring this aspect of female power. And in the book, I think it is kind of embodied by two similar yet opposite characters. One is obviously Semiramis, our protagonist, who rises to power without trying to bring other women down. Actually, she does seek the help of other women. She tries to include other women. And then there is the character of Nisat in the book, who is the mother of the king. And she is a woman who has had to sacrifice a lot to achieve her position. And she's similar to Semiramis in many ways because she's occasionally always cold hearted and very ambitious and willing to sacrifice most things to achieve power. But she has never kind of tried to reach out to other women. And so it was interesting to have these two characters, both female characters, both in a position of power, yet making slightly different choices along the way.
Right. Yeah. When you set out to write this book, did you already know a lot about Assyrian history or did you have to do a lot of research?
Actually, I didn't. And, you know, this was a huge challenge. So because with my first book, with Clytemnestra, as I was saying before, I was already familiar with a lot of the plays and tragedies and ancient Greek texts. Of course, I had to do a lot of research. I love doing research. I'm a proper, you know, research nerd. But with Babylonia, the challenge was much greater because I had to start from scratch. And so I had to spend months doing research before I even wrote anything. And then I kept doing this kind of, I would say, almost academic factual research as I wrote the book. And usually my kind of approach to research is both academic, as I said, but also what I call cultural. So the cultural research that allows me to, you know, recreate the texture of lived experience, to immerse myself into the mindset of these people. So rather than just, you know, facts and, you know, the weapons they use and the food they ate, I try also to focus on the ancient literature that these people would have been familiar with and what those kind of things taught us, can teach us about these people. And that is so, so important because it is the kind of research that makes readers, I believe, connect with the characters and really have a sense of the world.
Absolutely. And the level of detail that you have in this story is just amazing. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was Semiramis had a, in the book, has a pet leopard. Was that a historical fact or part of the legend?
So that specific choice is based on this beautiful painting of the Hanging Gardens, where there is Semiramis with a pet leopard on a leash. There are two paintings, actually, where Semiramis has pet leopards, but it's not something that appears in the myth, and it's not something that appears in the history. What we do know about leopards and lions, and this is instead an historical fact in ancient Assyria, is that the ancient Assyrians practiced what they called lion hunts. So they had this kind of arenas where kings, governors, and officials, especially kings, though, hunted lions and leopards for sport. And they did this because for them, the lions as animals were the symbol of chaos, whereas the Assyrian Empire was a symbol of order. And what I was trying to do in the novel, what I wanted to do in Babylonia, was to associate Semiramis with the image of a lioness, because she's in some sort of way the bringer of chaos, right? And so I kind of wanted her to have a pet leopard. But that was not in the original draft.
Okay.
I added that later on.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
The description of the lion hunt is not what I expected a lion hunt to be. This is more of a lion slaughter.
Yes, 100%. No, it really is. It's so heartbreaking. And that scene is based on the many Assyrian bas reliefs that we still have today. Most of them are at the British Museum in London, where we can see these kings and warriors, as you say, slaughtering rather than hunting.
Yeah, because they're not out in the jungle. They're not out in the on the savannah. They're the lions
captured.
Are captured, put in cages, let loose in arena. You know, it's like
it is heartbreaking, and they kind of build so much of the power of their power around this, the celebrations after the hunt. It was as if they used the killing of lions to kind of showcase their power. And as I said, this is based on actual Assyrian bas reliefs, where you can see all the different stages of the lion hunt.
Wow. So you had an opportunity to actually see these bas reliefs because you're in London.
Yes.
And they're there. And okay.
Yeah.
Are any
yeah.
of the cities that you wrote about still in existence?
No. So most of the interesting thing about the Assyrian Empire, and I would say about ancient Mesopotamia in general, which kind of brings us back to your brilliant question about why Greek myths are having a moment, is so for instance, why is Greek mythology so popular, and why do people know nothing about ancient Mesopotamia? This is because ancient Mesopotamia and most of these cities were discovered pretty late. They were discovered in the 20th century. Actually, no, sorry, 19th century, and they were discovered with a huge amount of bas reliefs and tablets, which were deciphered a few years later. And this is the reason why it kind of took us a while to become familiar with the culture of ancient Mesopotamia. So these cities were destroyed, but the tablets inscribed with cuneiform writing resisted, they endured. And this is because they were clay tablets. These clay tablets were put underground, they were buried, and they essentially, the clay can survive forever. And this is the reason why today we have thousands of clay tablets inscribed with ancient Mesopotamian poems, you know, proverbs, myths, love stories, food recipes. We have a pretty thorough record of life in ancient Assyria and ancient Mesopotamia thanks to these clay tablets that were discovered in the 19th century in the kind of remains of these Assyrian cities.
Now, was the writing still being used, that type of writing, or was it something that had been lost and had to be sort of rediscovered? Yes. And maybe, yeah, we didn't always get everything right.
Yes, no, it had to be deciphered. So when the tablets were discovered, it took them a while to understand it. It was a form of writing, which we now call cuneiform writing. The spoken language in ancient Mesopotamia at the time was Akkadian. So Assyrian and Babylonian were dialects of Akkadian. And then this cuneiform writing was deciphered by this kind of self-taught genius, essentially, called George Smith. There's a great book that came out recently, just last year, by the amazing Elif Shafak. It's called There Are Rivers in the Sky. And it actually is about this. One of the three characters is based on this self-taught genius who managed to decipher cuneiform writing. So yeah, it took them a while, but I think cuneiform writing was deciphered by, you know, the end of the 19th century.
So it would have been a lot easier for you to stick with Greek myths, sounds like.
Yes, so true. Yes. I mean, I will go back to Greek myths at some point in the future. But this is something that, you know, I really want to do with my career, and I'm doing with my next novel as well. I want to try different things. Obviously, my love for history is always there. So I think I will find a way to include history in most of my novels. But for instance, the novel that I'm working on now, which hasn't yet been announced, but essentially it's an historical fantasy set in Renaissance Italy. So I'm kind of changing genre slightly because I want to challenge myself with each book that I write.
Wow. Okay. Well, it sounds like you definitely are doing that. Now, you talked about the writer who had written the whole story of Semiramis. And what time period was he writing, and what language was he writing in?
So Diodorus of Sicily lived between 90 and 30 BCE. I actually mentioned two authors before. I don't know which one you're referring
that
to.
That was
one. Yeah. So Diodorus of Sicily was a Greek author who lived between 90 and 30 BCE, and he wrote a very long book called Bibliotheca Historica. It's essentially a universal history written in Greek. And he is the first author to write about Semiramis in detail. And I have based a lot of Babylonia on the myth of Semiramis as recounted by Diodorus. So what Diodorus tells us is essentially that Semiramis was an orphan, daughter of a goddess by the name of Dercito, who killed herself when Semiramis was a baby. This is not a spoiler because it happens literally in the first page of the book.
Yeah.
and then Semiramis was abandoned. And she was adopted. She somehow survived. This baby somehow survived. And she was adopted by a shepherd who took her with him to the village of Mari in the Assyrian Empire. She grew up there in poverty. And when she came of age, Diodorus tells us that Semiramis caught the attention of a man named Onnes, who was described as the governor and also the closest friend of the king, So Onnes marries Semiramis, takes her with him to the capital of Assyria, and here she meets the king. And this kind of, again, without giving any spoiler away, this kind of tragic love triangle forms, a love triangle that ends with Semiramis becoming queen. So this is kind of the legend as Diodorus tells it.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Costanza Casati, author of Babylonia. Costanza, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us today?
Of course, I would love to. So I was thinking, because we are avoiding spoilers again, that I could read a scene. This is a scene at the end of chapter two. Chapter two is called Semiramis, an Orphan Nobody. And it's just a couple of pages. So
great.
It gives us a glimpse into the backstory of Semiramis. There was a time when her life might have been very different, if only fate had been kinder. But gods are cruel and slippery, and they deal out destinies however it amuses them most. And what can humans do? They cannot change their past. Semiramis has learned this the hard way. Her mother killed herself when Semiramis was a baby. She was a beautiful woman and fell in love with a man who felt nothing for her. This is all Semiramis knows about her, that she was beautiful. Hair dark like a river, skin the color of the moon, eyes like black gemstones. These are only stories, songs sung by the villagers, slippery words told in whispers, passed from old women to curious children. But Semiramis has nothing else, so she has no choice but to believe they're true. When her mother fell pregnant, madness took hold of her. After Semiramis was born, she drowned herself in a lake. The elders of the village say that the water wanted to turn her into one of its creatures, but the gods would not let her give up her beauty. So they transformed her into something else, a woman with the tail of a fish. Others believe that their sister's body is just a corpse lying on the seabed, putrid and bloated, another thing the water swallowed. Sometimes images appear in Semiramis's sleep, a woman with green fish scales on her legs, urging her to join her in the water, but she cannot tell if they're dreams or memories. Alone on the rocks by the lake where her mother had died, the baby clung to life with the stubbornness of a clam. Around her, on the plains that were beginning to bud, white-feathered doves were laying their eggs in nests of twigs and grass. They came to the lakeshore in thousands in the months of spring, and when they heard a child's mournful cry, they mistook it for one of their own. They gathered beside the baby, keeping her warm with their soft wings, feeding her milk from their beaks. When Simmas came upon the scene, he thought it was a sign sent by the gods. He took the baby, asking travelers and villagers if they knew her mother. No one would claim her, so Simmas took her home to the village of Mari. His wife had died, giving birth to his only son, and he thought the daughter might be useful in the house as she grew up. He kept her in the hope of arranging a good marriage, one that might give him land and sheep, maybe even wine and new fabrics. He named her Semiramis because a Greek traveler had once taught him the word. Doves, it means, in the language of Abernari, and it is thought to bring luck because the birds are as sacred as goddesses. A strange name for a strange child. And strange Semiramis was, no matter how Simmas tried to teach her the ways of the village. She liked danger and all things that were forbidden. She spoke to animals and begged travelers to tell stories of the great cities of the empire, where lions and leopards roamed in gardens with gem trees of all colors. She was always looking for answers no one seemed able to give. Where does fruit come from? Why do flowers blossom? How far is the vault of the heavens? She could name the constellations in the night sky and how they trace the path of the sun and moon, knew which plants to use to create potions and ointments. She could play the lyre better than musicians who passed through the village. "Why do you want to learn everything?" her brother asked her once. She shrugged and said nothing, though the truth was that she enjoyed learning tricks and secrets because then she could use them to her advantage. She could show her brother how well she sang, diminish other children when they didn't know a proverb, heal herself when she was beaten. She was observant and curious in a way that no other villager was. When she was a child, growing up in a house that wasn't her own, Semiramis would convince herself that she was special, that she was meant for greatness. She would spend days fantasizing about her mother, who became a warrior, a queen, a goddess. In her dreams, Dorceto died fighting, protecting her child, close to the man she loved. It didn't matter that the villagers whispered that Semiramis was different, or that Simas told her she was worthless whenever she wouldn't obey him. Her mother was a goddess, traveling through the secret ways of water, drinking milk from the moon. For years, she has tried to give her life some sort of meaning, to convince herself that her destiny was charted when her mother left her alone on a rock. But then, on nights like this, when the village boy's words echo in her head like an unwanted visitor, the truth hits her so hard that she thinks she might choke. She's not special. She's just an orphan. She's nobody.
And that's Costanza Casati reading from Babylonia. When you're reading those stories from the Greek author, were you reading them in Greek or were you reading a translation?
No, I read them in translation. Yeah. I read them in translation. Can you imagine? I can translate Greek, but it just takes ages.
I'm sure. So what happened to the Assyrian people? Where are they now?
This is finally someone asks this question. I'm glad. Thank you for asking this, because the Assyrians haven't been forgotten. Of course, they're still here, but they are living kind of everywhere in the world. And there has been an Assyrian genocide, actually, and after that, an Assyrian diaspora. So this happened actually during the First World War, when most of the Assyrians were killed and they were kind of forced to leave the Middle East. And now some of them are still living there, but even in countries, in Middle Eastern countries, they are often kind of hated and vilified. Sometimes they're not allowed to teach their own costumes and stories. I think if people want to learn more about this, I highly, highly recommend the book that I mentioned before by Elif Shafak, There Are Rivers in the Sky, because the book is set in Mesopotamia, both ancient and modern day Mesopotamia. And the book follows three different characters and their relationship with rivers, specifically the rivers Tigris and Euphrates, the two big rivers that kind of cross the land of Mesopotamia. And the author shows in such a brilliant way how the, not Assyrians specifically, but the people from Mesopotamia have always faced this kind of struggle. They have always been kind of pushed to the margins and hunted almost, especially with Isis. The book of Elif Shafak also chronicles the arrival of Isis and how the Kurdish population was killed. It's a tragedy that it's not really talked about often, sadly.
Yeah, we tend to think of the Middle East as just all Arabs or Jews, and there's all these other groups.
Absolutely.
There.
Yes.
And many of whom have been there for centuries.
Centuries. Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that is the most heartbreaking thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That they have lived in those lands for such a long time and still they don't own these lands. It's terrible. It really is.
So, Costanza, in your bio, it mentions that you are a journalist and a screenwriter. So what type of journalism do you do and what type of screenwriting do you do?
So I actually used to work as a screenwriter and journalist. I don't anymore. Now I do writing. Yeah, full time. But I used to work for a Canadian magazine. I used to do film and book reviews. I attended, the Venice Film Festival for a few years in a row, and kind of covering the film festivals for this Canadian magazine. In terms of screenwriting, I have done a few short films and an art and history documentary in Italian. So after living in London for a few years, I moved back to Italy for a few years before the pandemic and worked on this art and history documentary on an Italian painter called Tintoretto. So you can see that the history obsession is still there. But yes, so I actually haven't written a script in a few years now, I would say in like 3 or 4 years. I wrote a short script for a friend's film in 2021 or 2022, which was quite different from what I normally work on. Nothing historical about it. It was kind of a philosophical exploration of the role of women in, you know, contemporary society. And it was inspired by contemporary authors like Gia Tolentino and Lisa Taddeo. But I would love to go back to screenwriting soon.
Well, is there any possibility of either of your books being made into movies?
Well, fingers crossed. We'll see. I have nothing to announce for now, but I would love that, especially because I wrote these books with, you know, kind of actors in mind. And I think my kind of training in screenwriting has influenced my fiction writing a lot, I would say.
And it's unusual for a novelist to write the screenplay for their own book, but sounds like you might.
I would love to do that. You know, just to be involved in any shape or form, I would be happy.
So what actress did you have in mind for Semiramis?
Well, for Semiramis, there is an amazing actress called Amita Suman. She did a fantasy series based on the Leigh Bardugo novels, Shadow and Bone. And she plays the character of Inez. And she, you know, I wasn't familiar with her. And then I watched the series before even reading the books because I hadn't read Leigh Bardugo at the time. Now I'm a big fan. But and she plays a character who is a warrior and who's very tough and has a very kind of mysterious beauty. And she's fascinating. So, yeah, Amita Suman, I would say. Yeah. But I find it so interesting when readers suggest actors or actresses after reading the book. I love when people reach out to me saying, oh, I thought of this actress. What do you think? I just find it such an interesting part of the process.
Well, I think a lot of times when you're reading, you're building a picture of someone in your mind, and it helps to have somebody to kind of to pin that character on.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree.
Now, one of Semiramis's skills in the book is cliff climbing, or, you know,
yes.
Rock climbing.
Yes.
Is that something that was common? Certainly wouldn't have been common for women back then necessarily, but in general, was that something that was utilized in
That's a great question. You know what? I do not know if it was common. So that particular skill of Semiramis comes from the Diodorus myth.
Okay.
Because there is a very long paragraph in the writing of Diodorus where he explains that Semiramis was the woman who came up with the winning strategy to make this foreign city surrender, the city of Balkh. And obviously this is a big part of my novel as well. And the strategy she came up with essentially was climbing. So she was the one who suggested climbing these apparently impregnable walls to reach the top of the city and force them to surrender. And because obviously I started writing a novel with the myth in mind, I knew that I had to make Semiramis a good climber from the beginning of the novel, because obviously I just, you know.
Right.
Start climbing at page 300 of the book and suddenly she's a great climber. No, I wanted her to be someone who, you know, has spent her life, her adolescence and childhood climbing, wandering around the hills. So that kind of scene in the first few chapters where she's climbing with the boys who then taunt her comes from this idea of me wanting Semiramis to be a good climber so that, you know, years later, she can find a way to make the city of Balkh surrender.
Now, as a child, she was, you know, and this is also, I don't think, is a spoiler because it's pretty early in the book, but her
yeah.
adoptive father's cruel, but
yeah.
her adopted brother is kind and tries to protect her. And were those in Diodorus?
No, Diodorus, no.
No.
They weren't actually. No,
Okay.
they weren't. So the interesting thing about the characters in Babylonia is that many of them were based on real people. So not even on the myth, like actual real historical figures. Obviously, their portrayal comes from my interpretation of historical sources, but characters like Ninus, characters like Nisat, Ilu, the commander of the Assyrian troops, he's also based on a real historical figure called Shamshi Ilu. And then there are other characters who are obviously made up. Some of these made up characters, even if they are made up, are based on kind of real histories. So for instance, Sazi is the spy master in the capital. He's a eunuch. He's a made-up character, but he's based on the fact that many, if not most, state officials and governors in ancient Assyria, in the Assyrian capitals, were eunuchs.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did they want to be eunuchs?
No, they didn't. No, they were kind of forced. And this was, this kind of practice was implemented by Assyrian kings because Assyrian kings had this strong belief that if a man could have no legacy, he could hold no power. This is obviously a notion that is challenged by Sazi himself in the book, right? Because he's the most ambitious of them all.
Yeah. But if you don't have offspring, at least the power would be limited to that lifetime and not
exactly that was the idea
passed
yes.
down. But were now Sazi was a slave at one point, or at least he was brought to this capital from a conquered city.
Yes,
were
exactly.
most of the eunuchs like that, or were they ever the native, citizens?
You know what? I don't know that. But the practice of deportation was that is also historically accurate. So Sazi wasn't a slave necessarily, but he was deported with many others from the west, from the Phoenician cities on the sea to the capital of Assyria. And here they were kind of given a choice. Do you want to be a slave? Do you want to be a eunuch? Do you want to be a prostitute?
Great choices.
Right? Yeah. Easy. Just give me 5 minutes. I need to think. So the practice of deportation was one of the kind of military tactics, actually, of the Assyrian Empire. Something that, the Romans themselves did, but Assyria did it on a huge scale. They did this to make sure that the conquered people could never rebel, because they kind of took these entire populations and moved them from the opposite side of the empire.
So how would they, it seems like if you bring, you capture somebody, you conquer their country, deport them, take them away from their home, and then you make them a eunuch. How are you going to trust that? And then you put them in a position of authority, but how are you going to trust them?
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah. And this is actually a very important question. It's a brilliant question because it's something that I have asked myself while writing the book. And it kind of explains, the question you just asked explains the behavior of the character of Sazi towards our protagonist, towards Semiramis in the book. Because when Semiramis arrives, Sazi is very hard to read as a character, but he clearly wants to be Semiramis's ally. And I think the question is why, but the answer, you kind of just gave the answer, right? This man probably, most probably hated the Assyrians. And then he sees Semiramis, a woman who is clever, who is cunning, who did nothing to him. She's not the reason why he has been mutilated. She's not the reason why he's been deported. And so he kind of puts his faith in her. That said, Sazi remains a very untrustworthy and slippery character.
And another character that you, in your author note, you said you've kind of added him a little bit later
yes
is the slave
Rabat, yes.
Rabat,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes,
And
so
tell us about him.
yes, so Rabat, so originally the novel had three POVs, but the third perspective was the one of the Princess Taria, so the princess of the Kingdom of Urartu. Yeah, and this was my very, very first draft. And then halfway through the first draft, Rabat's first line came to me out of the blue. Now I'm gonna start at the risk of sounding insane. This is something that sometimes happens. And you know, as an author, I first lines are so important. For me, what a first line can tell a reader about a character, what a first line can do in terms of the narrative. And Rabat's first line is in Babylonia. It's still the same. And it is, he has learned to read on the scar of his mother's back. And that first sentence just came to me, and I felt like I almost had Rabat as a character. I felt like I almost knew him. And then I thought about it for a while, and I realized that actually what this book needed, because this is a book about power, obviously it is about female power, female desire, female ambition. But I really needed the perspective of someone who had no power at all in the book, at least at the beginning, because then Rabat's arc is quite interesting as well. Again, no spoilers, but he doesn't stay a slave essentially. And in this respect, Semiramis and Rabat are quite similar because they see how, and they know how similar they are, because they start out as having nothing and they end up closer to the high heavens, you know, as they themselves say in the book. And I really like this idea of having two characters, two of the main characters on the one side who are traveling up, and the other two main characters, Onnes and Ninus, kind of going down. I mean, I love Onnes and Ninus, don't get me wrong, but this was kind of the structure of the book that I had in mind.
Right. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Costanza Casati, author of Babylonia. Let's just talk briefly about your path to publication with your first book. So, was Clytemnestra the first book you wrote, or just the first book you published?
It was the first book that was traditionally published. So
Okay.
I, before that, I had written a book that was actually a dystopian novel.
Ah,
Again,
okay.
challenging myself. And it is a book that I would love to go back to and kind of rewrite because I was quite young. It is a story that I love and a book that I really care for. And I self-published it because at the time I didn't really know how to find an agent. I mean, I did know how the submission process worked, but I was just doing it all wrong. Like having an agent now, I know that I was doing it all wrong. So I had submitted that novel to a few agents, never got a reply, so I decided to self-publish. But at the same time, I had already written Clytemnestra, so my kind of official debut was ready. And so while I was self-publishing that first novel, the dystopian novel, I was submitting Clytemnestra to agents. And this time, I kind of knew that I was doing it right in a way because I had followed this kind of course, online course about how to submit your novel, how to pitch your novel. These are things that, you know, authors should really learn to do. And because there are things that no one really teaches you. You know, I did a master's in writing and no one taught me how to submit
Oh,
my novel.
wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're so essential. So yes. So then I found my agent Victoria. She was kind of my dream agent, actually. So I found my agent for Clytemnestra, but then we kind of built my author brand from Clytemnestra onwards.
So was Clytemnestra part of a project that you worked on while you were doing your MA?
Yes. So I started writing the first scene I ever wrote was during my master's in writing, in creative writing. And I can't remember which scene. I think it was a scene where the two sisters, Helen and Clytemnestra, are dancing together in the training ground. And at the time, I think I already knew I wanted Clytemnestra to be a novel, not just, you know, a short story. And then in the following years, I kind of kept writing the novel. And then I submitted it in around 2020, so during the pandemic, and found my agent in 2021.
And it came out in 2023, and that's kind of normal for the process to take that long.
Yes.
Now, did you, with Babylonia, was it easier in terms of getting published?
Oh, yes, absolutely. 100%. You know, like now I have my team. They kind of know what I want to work on. They always know what I'm working on, what I want to work on. I have done until now a one book contract. You know, like book after book. And this is like my personal choice because I need, you know, I get obsessed like one thing at a time. So I never know what I'm going to work on next. And so I can't know now what my next book will be because I'm so focused on the one that I'm writing. But yes, obviously now I'm with, you know, in the UK, I'm with Penguin, with Source Books in the US. And so it is so much easier.
You made it as an author. You've actually really made it, haven't you? you're able to do it full time, and you've got great publishers, and you've got a great team. And does that make the writing any easier?
I think on the one side it does, because obviously I know I'm really, really lucky. You know, I kind of worked so hard to get here. This has always been my dream. So whenever I struggle, I tell myself, as soon as, you know, you were kind of 5 years old, you wanted to be an author. So you have it now. You cannot complain. But it is like, who am I to complain? Surely. I can,
and bopping back and forth between London and Paris. And
yeah. It sounds more glamorous than it actually is. but yes, sometimes it is hard, but it is hard in the sense that, you know, when you have amazing readers who kind of expect something from you, you know, like I'm a people pleaser. So if someone tells me, oh, it would be amazing if you worked on this, I obviously don't do it. I write books that I want to write. But I think once you kind of reach that level as an author, there are always people who want you to write certain things. Your team obviously will try to convince you to stick to a specific genre. My team is fantastic, and I love, you know, my editors, my agent, my publicist, everyone, and they kind of follow me on this adventure, and and they respect they kind of respect my wishes in terms of my creative wishes. But you need to stand up for yourself, you know, just like in any other job, every day, and kind of pitch your projects so that other people will be as obsessed with them as you are. You need to convince other people that what you're working on is going to be successful, even if you don't know it yourself, you know. So
right. You got to sell it.
Yes,
you got to sell it. Well, Costanza, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. You've been a lovely guest, and we always close with a quote, and I found one from Asha Banipal's collection of Sumerian and Babylonian proverbs.
Oh, wow.
Writing is the mother of eloquence and the father of artists.
That's beautiful. Love it. Oh, that great library, all those tablets have the most amazing quotes. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.